Last week I talked about fishing really leaving the starting gates here soon. For some of you it already has. The topic of last week's episode, specifically, was catch and release angling. A good topic, but a serious one. If you're not going to keep it, and I realize a lot of you are going to keep it, and more, it's not a bad thing to know how to release a fish back into the water in a reasonably healthy state, ensuring it'll live to see another day. For those who actually know me, they know that while I can certainly hold forth on more serious topics, my default mode is humor, not that I claim to be funny. Rather, I like to laugh. I like to see and hear other people laughing. I like funny stuff. I say that while acknowledging the fact that humor is a very subjective thing. What I think is funny, you might not. Still, I thought today we'd keep it on fishing with summer and fishing coming at us full bore, but switch gears and go a funny route with fishing, or at least what I hope will be a funny route. Today, let's talk about fish poles and other useful terminology. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Visitor Services Manager for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. In saying that last line, it's not my words. Fish poles and other useful terminology. That's the title of a story by the late Patrick McManus in one of his earliest books, Never Sniff a Gift Fish. It was the first McManus book I ever purchased, and I bought it for my grandfather for his birthday in 1984. Pat signed that for my granddad. The signing date is May 20th, 1984, and he wished him happy birthday. Today, let's consider fish poles and other terms associated with fishing. So, when we're on the water in the coming weeks, we have our fishing jargon down pat, pun intended. I have long held the opinion that a person should know the jargon of any activity in which he professes some expertise. A writer, for example, should not refer to quotation marks as those itty-bitty ears. It is unsettling to hear the carpenter you have just hired refer to his hammer as a pounder. A mechanic tinkering with the innards of your car arouses anxiety by speaking of a pair of pliers as his squeezer. Similarly, it would be disconcerting to have a doctor tell you that he detected an irregularity in your thingamajig. Ignorance of proper terminology often leads to confusion, alarm, and panic, especially when one talks about the sport of fishing. I recently met a man and his son out bass fishing. The father was making superb cast with what was obviously a new rod. "Is that a boron you've got there?" I asked. The man turned and looked at his son. Well, he ain't too bright, that's for sure. Here was a case where a man had mastered the art of fishing but failed to keep up on recent nomenclature. I could hardly blame him. I now spend so much time learning all the new fishing terms that I scarcely have time to fish. Consider just a few of the terms you now must learn in order to go out and catch a few bass. Structure, isolated structure, sanctuary, stragglers, break line, suspended fish, pattern, holding area, riprap, point, scatter point, contact point, cheater hook, buzz bait, Texas rig, crankbait, triggering, flippin', pH, jig and pig, spinner bait, fly and rind. The aerospace industry requires less technical jargon than the average bass fisherman. When I was younger, my friends and I could get by on fewer than a dozen fishing terms. No doubt, we could have expanded our angling vocabulary by going to the county library and checking out a book on fishing techniques. The problem was that if one of the gang showed up at the library to check out a book, Miss Phelps, the librarian, might have suffered a heart attack on the spot. Enlarging our vocabularies didn't seem worth the risk of taking a life. We chose to get by on the few terms we knew. Although our fishing terminology was limited, it was not without its own peculiar complexity. Take the word keeper, for example. The first fish you caught was always a keeper. This was not the result of outrageous coincidence, but definition. The first fish was interpreted as a keeper merely by having a mouth big enough to stretch over the barb of the hook. There were several advantages to this definition of keeper applying to the first fish. Suppose the first fish you caught during the day was also the only fish, and you had released it. That would have meant that you would have had to go home skunked, an angling term every bit as significant then as it is today. Calling the first fish a keeper often prevented the emotional damage which resulted from going home skunked. Furthermore, if someone later asked you if you had caught any fish, you could reply, in reference to a fish no longer than a pocket knife, just one keeper. The phrase, just one keeper, implied, of course, that you had caught and released numerous small fish, thereby contributing to one's reputation as a sportsman. If the first fish was particularly small, it did not always stay a keeper. A larger fish, when caught, became a keeper, and the small first fish became badly hooked. You always explained with a note of regret in your voice that you had kept the badly hooked fish because it would have died anyway. Proper fishing terminology, even in the time of my youth, was extremely important, both socially and psychologically. Although some of our terms might seem simple by today's standards, they were not without their own subtle shades of meaning. Take the word mess, for instance, which was the word used to denote your catch while telling someone about your day of fishing. Mess, used without modifiers, usually meant two fish, a keeper and a badly hooked. A small mess referred to a single keeper. A nice mess meant three fish, excluding any badly hooked. Any number of fish over three was, naturally, a big mess. To ask for specific numbers was considered rude when somebody told you he had caught a big mess of fish. Today the phrase, a mess of fish, is seldom heard, probably because anyone uttering it would instantly be identifying himself as a fish glutton. Quantity of the catch is now always referred to by specific numbers, although a certain element of deception is still retained. An angler who has spent 12 hours flailing a trout stream and managed to land a total of three fish responds to a question about the number of fish caught by saying, "I only kept three." If asked exactly how many he caught and released, he will be overcome by a coughing fit and have to rush from the room. It took me 15 minutes the other day to memorize the name of my new casting rod, and I've already forgotten it. When I was younger, we didn't have to memorize the names of our rods because we didn't have any. We had what were called fish poles. Even now, after nearly 40 years, I will still occasionally refer to a $300 custom-built fly rod as a fish pole. "That's a nice fish pole you got there," I'll say to the owner of the rod. He will go wide in the face, shudder, twitch, gurgle, clench his hands, and lurch toward me. "What did you say? Fish pole? You called my $300 rod a fish pole?" I will back away, hands raised to fend him off, and explain that I have never shaken a bad habit picked up in childhood. Fish pole, in the old days, was a generic term for any elongated instrument intended for the purpose of propelling hook, line, sinker, and worm in the general direction of fish holding water, and then wrenching an unlucky fish to the bank with as little fuss as possible. Some fish poles were made from cedar trees that had been rejected as too short or too slender for use as telephone poles. A few fortunate kids own metal telescoping fishing poles. My first fish pole was a single-piece stiff metal tube about 6 feet long. There was a wire that could be pulled out of the tip if you wanted action. I never pulled the wire out. Action, in my fishing circles, was not considered a desirable characteristic in a fish pole. It merely complicated the process of wrenching the fish from the water, or landing it. Forked stick is a term seldom heard among anglers nowadays, which is too bad because the forked stick once served to enrich both fishing and conversations about fishing. "I prefer the forked stick to a creel for carrying fish," a kid would say. "The creel is too bulky and keeps catching on brush. It gets in your way when you're casting too. Most creels are too small for really big fish anyway. Give me a forked stick to a creel anytime." The statement actually meant, "Give me a fork stick any time until somebody gives me a creel, then I'll prefer a creel." The theory of the fork stick didn't work out in practice because the kid never ever thought about cutting a fork stick until he had caught his first fish. To cut a stick prior to catching a fish would have been presumptuous and probably bad luck to boot. Also, few things look more ridiculous than an angler walking around with an empty fork stick. Once a fish had been caught, the youngster, in his excitement, would instantly forget the aesthetically pleasing proportions prescribed for the forked stick. He would twist off the nearest branch with the fork on it, gnaw away any obstructing foliage with his teeth, thread the fish onto it, and then get back to fishing. When you were catching fish, you didn't have time to mess with aesthetics. The forked stick contributed much excitement to our fishing. Since a double forked branch or willow was almost never available when needed, the forked stick could not be hooked under your belt, but had to be laid down somewhere while you fished. Once or twice every hour, a panicky search would begin for a string of fish left on a log or rock, just around the last bend. Approximately 30% of your fishing time was spent trying to catch fish, and 70% looking for fish you had already caught. Thus, the term forked stick denoted not merely a device for carrying your catch, but a whole mode of fishing that the boy who grows up owning a creel can never come to know or appreciate. He should consider himself damn lucky for it, too. There is at least one indication that many terms and phrases closely associated with fishing may soon be made obsolete. A new reel on the market is reputed to virtually eliminate backlash, that wonderfully intricate snarl of line that served to enrich the vocabularies of anglers ever since reels were invented. It seems likely the eradication of backlash could mean the end of such colorful expressions as bleeping bleep of a bleep bleep. Truly, the language of fishing will be less for the absence of backlash. A fork stick. Does any of you actually use a fork stick anymore? I confess, I used one last summer. My youngest and I were fishing the mouth of the Snake River and caught a few char that we intended to bring home for my wife. I failed to bring a stringer of any sort, so a few moments searching the riverbank, with some help from my leatherman, and we were set. Do you doubt what I'm saying? Check out the photo for this episode on the KDLG website. You'll see a photo of my daughter holding a forked stick with a big mess of Arctic char. I am happy enough to tell you that none of them were badly hooked. They all stood on their own merits. We did not need a keeper to explain the badly hooked one, and we actually did release a bunch of small fish. All that to say, McManus's words are just as true today as they were in the days of his youth. Some things are just pretty much timeless. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.